Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hi, I'm Kerry O'Brien, and I'm coming to you from Bundjalung country and wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land and pay my respects to their elders past and present. And I extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders peoples listening in. It's also important to note that the sovereignty of the Bundjalung Nation has never been ceded. On behalf of the Melbourne Writers Festival, I'm leading a conversation which goes to the heart of the kind of democracy we are at risk of becoming, as opposed to the democracy we'd like to think we have. It's worth noting that only 8.4% of the world's people enjoy what we might call full democracy, and Australia is part of that 8%. But both my guests come to this discussion with deep concerns about an increasing appetite by government for secrecy, for an avoidance of scrutiny, with a pattern of laws under the umbrella of national security and national interest. Bernard Collaery, the veteran Canberra lawyer, human rights campaigner and former ACT Attorney General, has learned the hard way. He's being prosecuted by the Commonwealth under the Intelligence Services Act for telling journalists 8 years ago that Australia had illegally bugged the East Timorese government's cabinet rooms while renegotiating a seabed oil and gas treaty with them, the implication being it was for Australia's commercial advantage. Collaery was acting for East Timor in its case under international law to nullify the treaty and intended using the potentially damning evidence of a senior ASIS, ASIS whistleblower known to us only as Witness K. My other guest is investigative journalist and author Andrew Fowler, also a former colleague of mine at the ABC. Andrew first interviewed WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange, a foreign correspondent in 2010, and subsequently wrote the best-selling book, The Most Dangerous Man in the World, which has been translated and published across the globe. Andrew has continued to stay in touch with Assange and follow the ongoing attempts by the US to extradite him from Britain, where he has now languished in a high-security prison for 3.5 years. His alleged crime was to publish secret US military documents leaked by US whistleblower Chelsea Manning, with acutely embarrassing and compromising revelations about US actions in Iraq and Afghanistan. Welcome to you both. First, Bernard, to you a brief bit of background. You had intended to take Witness K, who had been a senior ASIS agent, to the International Court in The Hague to assist East Timor's case to withdraw from its oil and gas treaty with Australia. The Australian government withdrew Witness K's passport, which meant he couldn't go to The Hague. I know you're seriously restricted on what you can talk about, but can you say how the absence of Witness K affected East Timor's case?
I think the main impact was the total breach of good faith. International arbitration is founded on good faith between the parties. I can't go back to the anterior conduct Australia was accused of, but this was a doubling down on bad faith. I thought it was significant, Kerry, that as time progressed, the Director General of ASIO, I can say quite openly, Duncan Lewis, twice refused a request from the then Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, to continue a ban on Witness K having his passport replaced. On both occasions, ASIO was not of the view that Witness K was a threat to national security. I found that very significant at the time, and since then I've been careful when I refer to the Australian government. I'm not too sure whether it is a whole of government issue, this whole Timor matter, because all of the notable issues have stemmed from a much smaller group of politicians.
Back in Australia, Witness K has since pleaded guilty to breaching national security laws, and his own trial in Canberra was completely shrouded in secrecy. In a recent speech, you described Australia's national security powers as authoritarian and now encroaching on every citizen more than similar powers in any other Western democracy. Was Witness K's trial an example of what you're talking about? And this is the trial of a whistleblower.
to start with, by entering a plea, there was no trial. The magistrate presiding elected to accept that plea. And as we all know, there are occasions when a court won't accept a plea. I have views on that issue, however, that the matter's now closed in one sense. But what I want to say publicly is that I look for the day, hopefully, after the proceedings against myself are completed, and again, I hope successfully, that there'll be a proper approach by the government of the day. Hopefully, our democracy will survive and re-flourish to the Governor-General for a pardon for this embattled, very good human being, Witness K.
But the overriding fact of that case was that had it proceeded to a full trial, it would have been shrouded in secrecy. Is his case an example of what you're talking about when you say that Australia's national security powers are authoritarian and encroaching on every similar citizen more similar powers than any Western democracy?
Well, of course. I mean, there was no national security aspect to the hearing. This is a government anxious to cover up embarrassing material. There was nothing there that could possibly prejudice our national security. Indeed, the very act of putting him through a sentencing process behind a black screen probably damaged our image more in the world than anything else. Here was a man being tried, like the 1930 Moscow trials of Stalin's generals, in secret, being sentenced in secret with a ration of information only to come out to the media of issues. And all the Russians knew while their generals were being struck down because they were potential competitors to Stalin, and all Australians knew in that terrible week when Witness K was brought in behind a black screen that this lowered our democracy to utter depths in the name of national security.
So in your own trial, which is still proceeding, large swathes of evidence were also going to be heard in secret, but you've just won an appeal on the basis that if the evidence cannot be publicly disclosed, there was a very real risk of damage to public confidence in the administration of justice, and that open hearings help deter political prosecutions. So how significant was that ruling for you, both in terms of what it meant for you practically and in terms of the principle it was reflecting?
Well, just briefly in terms of what it meant for me, if I'm to be convicted and sentenced, the public won't know what I did, what I'm accused of doing, and they won't know whether I've acted in good faith or dishonourably, who will employ me again as their lawyer, barrister, and how can I hold my head up in court? It would ruin me. The very secrecy of it would prevent me from explaining anything. In terms of the national outlook, this is a government that is unabashed by that judgment. As you know, the judgment is still in the purse of the Attorney General, who wants to redact it. And we will be arguing against the redaction of the judgment. So you don't even have the judgment, Kerry, yet. We just know the victory. You don't know the basis for it. But be that as it may, the next round is already being signalled. And that is the government wishes to indicate or move, we'll wait to know whether it will appeal that judgment. That's an important issue. And another important issue is whether the government's, I think the ABC reported this, so I can repeat it again, the government wants to have judge-only evidence in another round. Whether that will be heard or not by the original judge, we wait to see. So there's no resolution and there's no way forward this moment to see at the end of this prosecution.
I'm talking broadly now, not directly about the judiciary involved in your own case, but how confident are you that the judiciary has what it needs to properly protect the rule of law, which is what we're talking about when we talk about open court versus secret court, the rule of law, which is absolutely one of the cornerstones of democracy. So how confident are you that the judiciary has what it needs to properly protect the rule of law in the face of a government's determination to drive legislation that might represent a threat to it?
It's a balance. In wartime, the scales sometimes swing into prudency And for abundant caution, we might detain so-called enemy aliens and the rest. But in peacetime, the use of these measures is unprecedented and a direct threat, in my view, to the rule of law. I can't instant the issues in my case. Since the Magna Carta, the Great Charter, there has been a right to jury trial. One of the few rights in our Australian Constitution is that someone charged with an indictable offence facing indictment, as I am, I'm entitled to jury trial, Section 80 of the Constitution. How am I to get a jury trial if there'll be judge-only evidence? How am I to get a jury trial, my right, if 12 citizens who come forward to judge me may not hear the full evidence and may receive judicial direction? I'm for trial by my peers, 12 of them. But if there has to be judicial direction on the basis of judge-only evidence, where is my constitutional right to trial by jury? I mean, there are fundamental questions now in our country as a result of 9/11, post-9/11 legislation, and we need to get that balance right. It's the excessive desire for secrecy about secrets that are not national security secrets. They are secrets about partisan political decision-making, partisan political conduct or misconduct, and other matters that have perceived electoral disadvantages. And those laws were never intended for that. They were intended to protect us from terrorism, extremist action, and foreign interference and espionage.
You have said that powers have been used in your case and the case of Witness K that have not been used in any terrorist matter before the courts in Australia. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. Indeed. The full force of those provisions have been deployed in this matter, fully deployed, and particularly the attempts on foot at the moment to have judge-only evidence.
So when a court determines, and you talked about, you know, what is the national interest earlier, but when a court determines that a trial should be held in secret because evidence might damage Australia's national interest, do you accept that it might genuinely be in the national interest to suppress information that could embarrass the government in the eyes of its neighbours and damage important relationships?
Oh, indeed. Indeed, and I think I've been privy and party to that as on my feet as counsel in defence-related matters, inquiries in relation to military deaths and the rest. Of course, I'm a great supporter of the concept that we should protect our ability to function and be an exemplary democracy, particularly in our region. But where has our exemplary function gone now? That's the question I ask. I can't address the conduct vis-a-vis Timor, but I can gauge public opinion. And I don't recall ever having been an advocate for the Timorese for the last 20, 30 years, ever being stopped in the street by a member of the public and chipped about that advocacy. But look, when I have done murder trials and other matters of that nature, I'm often tapped on the shoulder and given a very candid view of who I've represented. It doesn't happen. I don't think the public are with this government on this issue, and I don't think the public, in their own good sense, the way a jury has, this is a jury of 20-odd million, have any empathy at all with the idea that to reveal this conduct would damage our country in any way. There should have been an apology for maverick conduct very quickly made and proper reparations given, and that hasn't happened.
You said in that speech that I referred to earlier, and I'm talking now in relation to the security laws that you say have never been used against terrorists but used against you. You said that that they were used particularly on you, quote, this is in your recent speech, to cover Downer's dirty linen. And now you're obviously referring there to Alexander Downer, who was foreign minister at the time of the Timor Treaty renegotiation. Are you saying that there has been a clear political motivation behind these trials? And are you able to talk about it?
I'm not able to talk about it. I'm most anxious to talk about it. And if it requires me to have my day in court, I'm most anxious to do that. But probably at the moment, as the orders issued stand, I won't have that opportunity.
Okay. Andrew, in the case of Julian Assange and the massive intelligence dump he orchestrated as WikiLeaks editor that was so embarrassing to a range of countries, including Australia, what parallels do you see with the Witness K, Kaleri cases and America's determination to prosecute Assange? That is, if you do see any parallel. And do you acknowledge that democracies like America and Australia have a right to protect their national security and intelligence laws in their genuine national interest, assuming that national interest ultimately means your interest and my interest in the case of Australia?
Well, Kerry, look, the cases involving Bernard and Witness K and Assange are bound together, in my opinion, by one common imperative of executive government, and that is to silence those who pose questions of their possible criminality in these cases. I mean, in the Kaleri Witness K case, it's about possible crimes in the name of government, in this case committed by ISIS. The Assange case, revealing the evidence of war crimes in Iraq, the shooting down of innocent civilians, assassination squads in Afghanistan, torture, Guantanamo Bay, and the list goes on and on. As with the case of national security, yeah, of course. I mean, every community, every country needs to protect its citizens.
Andrew, in the case of Julian Assange and the massive intelligence dump he orchestrated as WikiLeaks editor, that was so embarrassing to a range of countries, but particularly America, what parallels do you see with the Witness K. Kaleri cases and America's determination to prosecute Assange? And do you acknowledge that democracies like America and Australia have a right to protect their national security and intelligence laws in their national interest, assuming that the national interest ultimately and genuinely means your interest and my interest?
The cases involving Bernard, Witness K, and Assange are bound together, in my opinion, by a common imperative of executive government to silence those who pose questions of their possible criminality. The Kaleri Witness K case is about possible crimes committed in the name of the government by, in this case, ISIS. The Assange case, revealing the evidence of war crimes in Iraq, the shooting down of innocent civilians, assassination squads in Afghanistan, torture of Guantanamo Bay, the list goes on and on. As for the case of national security, yes, every country needs to protect. In fact, it's central to a government's role to protect its citizens. But national security has nothing to do with the Witness K case and Bernard's case and the Assange case. These are revenge prosecutions, in my opinion, revenge prosecutions by executive government, and it's executive government, not parliamentary government, not the broad church of government, but by the executive powers that are increasingly a problem, in my opinion, being caught red-handed in seemingly criminal acts. And that is the real danger that we face. I think the central issue of executive government overreaching, over-empowering, clearing all opposition and speaking with a single voice, an authoritarian voice. And that's the danger that we face. And we face this not only as people representing, you know, lawyers such as Bernard representing people, but journalists representing the information that we get and passing that on to the public and dealing with whistleblowers. It's a major problem, a major threat to not just journalism, but I think to the democracy that it underpins.
Of course, you've written in your own book about responsible whistleblowing versus irresponsible whistleblowing. How do you draw that distinction, and how do you relate that principle to Julian Assange and his actions? So we're talking, one, the whistleblower in this case was Chelsea Manning, but it was his choice to judge whether that act of whistleblowing was responsible.
Well, it was. I mean, Chelsea Manning could have just dumped the 600,000 cables and various reports onto the internet and had done with it. But she chose not to do that. She chose to go to Julian Assange and to WikiLeaks and to talk to somebody who would go through the process, the journalistic process, of deciding what to release and what not to release. So I think that was what I would call, a strange word to use, but responsible whistleblowing. I mean, whistleblowing, by its sheer definition, is blowing the whistle on something that the person deems to be wrong and needs public exposure. And let's not forget that whistleblowers do not blow the whistle easily. They're very often completely tortured by what they know. And it's only at the last moment that they'll resolve that the only way forward, having maybe gone through various different channels to see whether or not, in the case of Edward Snowden, whether or not this wrong could be put right. And in the end, it can't be done, and so they go to the media as a last resort. And in Manning's case, she went there because she went to WikiLeaks because she didn't trust the mainstream media. I mean, she didn't trust the New York Times and the Washington Post because of their complicity in the Iraq War. And a lot of this goes back to the Iraq War, and it goes back to those, in my opinion, criminal acts of the invasion. And so whistleblowers came out, in this case, the case of Manning, to blow the whistle on what she thought was a criminal act that the public needed to know about. And Assange acted like a journalist and processed material and, generally speaking, got it out in good order.
We know that a significant number of senior journalists have expressed unease, if not opposition, to what they say was an indiscriminate release of material, even though some of that, according to the claims of the American government and others, that the release in some cases could have led to the deaths of people in other countries where potential sources of American intelligence could have been revealed.
Well, yeah, could have, maybe. I mean, those are the words the intelligence agencies use all the time. I mean, don't do this, it might do that, don't do that, it might do that. We'll protect you. They are very slow in putting forward the evidence to show that they've protected you, having taken away many of your rights to do things and to reveal information. There is no evidence whatsoever that the release of the documents by WikiLeaks led to any death at all. All the hundreds of thousands of documents that were released. And how do we know that? Because the Pentagon investigated in some detail during Chelsea Manning's trial to discover if that was so, because they'd love to have pinned that on her, and they couldn't do it. So if the Pentagon can't find people that have been killed as a result of the release of these documents, then I would suggest that nobody died. The question of whether or not other journalists think that WikiLeaks is some kind of malevolent force in the world or somehow a very loose journalistic organisation shouldn't carry the label of journalism, I would suggest that those people should look very closely at what they see as being journalism, because what I often see is just the reverse. I see the person with the loudspeaker, the executive government, being broadcasting information that journalists very operate in note form and rebroadcast without questioning. So to answer your question about journalists and what they do and don't do and what WikiLeaks should and shouldn't do, I think that WikiLeaks is a much better journalistic organisation and has produced material to the benefit of us all, more so than many of the publications that have criticised WikiLeaks.
Can you just briefly update us on exactly where America's extradition case is right now? Because the US appeal on the British court's decision not to allow his extradition will be heard this week. I mean, let's assume that appeal is upheld. Presumably America keeps, that appeal is rejected. America keeps pushing.
Well, America, if it's rejected, the appeal's rejected, then Assange will go free.
Well, they have a further right of appeal, don't they, to the Supreme Court?
Well, then Assange will go free unless they appealed then to the Supreme Court.
Oh, I see what you mean.
On a technicality, order on the matter of law. But yes, Assange is in the High Court tomorrow, our time, and the United States Department of Justice will spend their time trying to demolish the reputation of the psychiatrist who said that Assange was in danger of committing suicide if he were to be extradited to the United States. Now, if they're successful in damaging his reputation to the extent they don't accept his evidence, then Assange would then have to appeal to the Supreme Court and possibly after that make his way to the European Human Rights Court. Whatever happens, it would appear that Assange will spend several more months in prison. But let's say, for example, that he is freed onto the early winter streets of London in a few days' time, or a few weeks' time after the court's made its decision. Still doesn't mean he's free. He can still be picked up off the streets and extradited back to the United States and any country he travels through. So it's not over. It's a continuing problem for him, no matter what happens.
One of the notable aspects of the Assange case is that Democrat presidents, as well as Republicans, have pursued his prosecution, and Labour prime ministers, as well as Conservative, have been equally reluctant to intercede on his behalf in this country. What do you draw from that, that it is across politics?
Well, look, in the case of the United States, the original reason not to prosecute was the New York Times problem, which was as you know, the issue of the First Amendment protection and what would it mean if they prosecuted Julian Assange for American journalists. So that's why Obama and his DOJ held off on that prosecution. It was then later that Biden, at that time as vice president, described Assange as a high-tech terrorist. So there were no friends there in the United States establishment. And I don't think you can really draw any difference between the political parties in America, between one side and the other when it comes to this issue. They would love to prosecute Assange, but they fear the problems of the backlash from their very nationalist media. Because not to bore you with too much detail, hopefully, but the American media has a very close relationship with the military establishment. It clears a lot of material before it publishes. It's got freedom of speech and protections under the Act, but it doesn't always exercise them to its fullest ability. So it's a very cozy relationship. In this country, the problem we have is that we are, unfortunately, in my opinion, rather too close to the United States and lean too much on them for our security, which is a very questionable, I think, definition of whether or not we're more secure by being close to the United States.
But Andrew, that in a way is the point. That could work both ways. If an Australian government was of a mind to intercede on Assange's behalf and ask for him as an Australian citizen to be able to come back to Australia, they could surely use the strength of the relationship, the strength of the alliance, and the importance America places in it to make that case.
Look, I'm not too sure, having read a number of books on the issue, how much the Americans really care about the alliance that much. I think that the fear is that if this government was prepared to burn any political capital with the Americans, it wouldn't be on the question of Julian Assange. I'm not sure which government would do that, given that we've got any political capital at all to burn with them. About the only thing we've got going for us here is Pine Gap, which is probably going to become, I thought, the next 5-10 years redundant because of the way that other systems of interception can pick up material now. Spacing of B-52s in Darwin, that's been there since 1982. Those sort of issues, I'm not too sure how much clout we've got. I do think it's a good idea, though, to stand up and say, as an independent sovereign state, that we want this person to be dealt with fairly and for him to be returned to Australia and for him not to be prosecuted for an act of journalism, which is a strong point for journalists to make. And what I'm surprised, Gary, is that we don't hear it being made strongly enough or often enough.
Bernard, you said in your speech in September that, quote, the public interest holds an inherent continuum of decency, ethical standards and morality that should survive political vicissitudes. The national interest is part only, this is you still talking, the national interest is part only of the public interest in the pursuit of democratic ideals. How do you relate that view to the Australia you see today in terms of democratic openness?
The public, because of 9/11 and because of Iraq and Afghanistan, and our general support for our armed services, have an affinity with the concept of national security. They see that as a reference to their security. And what's drifted away on this iceberg of isolation, particularly in the Antipodes in this part of the hemisphere, has been the core issue of public interest. Now, nothing demonstrates the difference between national interest and public interest than the prevailing view in the public about the events between Australia and East Timor. The Australian public are solidly pro-Timor and critical of this alleged misconduct because they represent the public opinion, the public interest. The Australians see clearly the public interest in that issue. They don't fully see the public interest in the Julian Assange issue because of the reference to these national security concepts. But we've got to move our country back. There is a change of government at the next general election. There has to be an emphasis on a return to rule of law. There has to be a root and branch dismemberment of the national security legislative structuring that's occurred, the misuse of those provisions or the overuse of provisions. And there has to be an acknowledgement by our political leaders that popularism, xenophobia, has no place in a modern Australian society.
One of the problems that you've got in that wish is that Labor in opposition, and I think it can be said at times Labor in government, can be quite intimidated at the thought that they could be wedged on the holy cow of national security if they stick their neck out on a point of principle. So what chance do you have given the state of politics in Australia today across the spectrum?
Well, we're clinging to hope. I mean, I think Labor realises it was burned on the East Timor issue. I think it's pretty obvious that Julia Gillard was not properly briefed on the issue, and I was not given the real facts. I think Labor would be a little more aware and sensible about being led by the nose again by the so-called national security apparatus in this country. I think there's been also a change of batons within the structure. I think there are persons of considerable integrity now leading some of the agencies, and I think there's been a little bit of cleanup done behind the scenes. I'm confident that after the next election, if this current government are re-elected, I think there'll be Armageddon on people like Andrew Fowler here and myself. I think there'll be no stopping the plunge into this abyss that we're moving.
Because the abyss, the potential abyss that I'm talking about is important as the particular elements you're talking about, covers across the decline of the spirit and letter of how freedom of information laws, the effectiveness is declining, the worries about the freedom of the press, the absence of stronger whistleblower legislation, the complete reluctance of the government to embrace a proper anti-corruption body with teeth. I mean, when you look across the board, and I'll ask this of you, Andrew, and then come back to Bernard, how demonstrable is it to you that government in Australia is becoming more secretive, more opaque across the board?
Well, I mean, I see that every day in my reading of newspapers and watching television and listening to interviews and seeing how government ministers don't answer questions and maintain their airtime. But on a personal level, I've made a number of freedom of information requests, particularly relating to the Assange case, and have had, as you can probably imagine, very limited assistance from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. But there is one specific, and I've got a complaint to the Ombudsman on that issue, but there is one specific example I can give you. In Madrid, in Spain, there was a case where there were arrests made because some Spanish security companies had been illegally, at the behest of the United States, spying on Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy. And so I've been examining that. It's in my book, and I was thinking, okay, well, I can take this a bit further. I'll ask the Madrid office, I'll ask DFAT, any cable traffic, any notes, any information between Spain and Canberra relating to this matter. It's a pretty, you know, whatever you've got. And I received a freedom of information, a reply from DFAT saying they had absolutely no information whatsoever on this matter. I've appealed on that, and it'll go on for another year, I suppose. But that is blatantly and obviously untrue, unless, of course, everything is put through the ACES operative there. But I can't imagine that the ambassador hasn't sent a clipping of El Pais, anything, a note to say, well, the Assange case is hotting up here again. Absolutely nothing from DFAT. And they just don't care. I mean, this is the point. I mean, they just stonewall you. They just say, what does it matter? I mean, they're very nice about it, but you get nowhere. And in the end, what this does is this says to journalists who are trying to unravel this and get behind these walls is to say, so who can we talk to? Who can we get who will give us information, who will leak information to us from inside government because we cannot go in through the normal channels? They're actually creating whistleblowers inside government because you educate people to abide by the constitution, abide by the rule of law, and then you don't do that as executive government. So what you then get is people like Ed Snowden, who was educated to uphold the constitution. He joins the NSA, finds they're breaching the constitution and blows the whistle. That is what happened in Australia, in my opinion. You'll get whistleblowers blowing the whistle.
By the same token, those in the government who practice the great art of deception with regard to freedom of information might still think that they're ahead, given the great body of information that they're still able to flock as against the number of whistleblowers who might stick their head up.
Well, that's true, Kerry, true. I mean, I think you're right that they are winning the game. But in the end, if you create a hermetically sealed vessel, the pressure inside eventually, I would suggest, would reach a breaking point. One of the reasons why whistleblowers are good for democracy is because the steam's let off. The steam's let off and the pressure deflates. If you keep building up the pressure, I think you're causing problems.
Bernard, you've lived your life in the culture of Canberra. You've been in government yourself in the ACT. You've conducted many cases around the cultures of government. How demonstrable is it to you that Australia is becoming more secretive, more opaque across the board?
It's the worst that I've ever seen. It is in a very fragile state, our democracy. Executive is now ruling with a thumb towards the rule of law. All those matters, denial of legitimate freedom of information requests, attempts to suborn the media, attempts to tell my profession, the legal profession, that we're not to represent people who come forward with moral issues from the intelligence apparatus. All of this is designed to intimidate, to withhold information from the public, and to preserve to the executive the most authoritarian powers that Australia has known, even exceeding those used in wartime. I think, Kerry, when you look across the board, the real malaise is in this excessive secrecy, the desire to avoid criticism above all, and the denial to the Australian people of the truth of issues. It's an attempt to manufacture a society based on executive concepts of what is to be known to the public and what the public may consume. It is a very dire prediction of mine that if this government, this executive is re-elected, and if Labor come into power unreformed, then our democracy is at considerable risk.
It's a hard thing to measure, isn't it, Bernard, when you have a gradual drip-by-drip erosion of something as ephemeral, if you like, as democracy. There's no easy measure of that, is there?
No, there isn't. But, I mean, if you read Henry Lawson, if you read the constitutional debates at the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century, there were so many people anxious to create a working democracy in our country. And we were going to be, and my generation after the Second World War believed we were building an exemplary society. We truly believed that. And we got close to it. And from the mid-60s onwards, it has eluded us, and we've gone deeper and deeper in the mire of restricting our democracy to a rationed out feed of executive pronunciations and the rest.
Andrew, you touched on the failure of journalism to some degree in relation to Assange. But in terms of what we're talking about now, of Bernard's fears about the erosion of democracy in Australia, where a strong media presence and a free media presence is supposed to be another of those cornerstones of democracy, along with the parliament and the rule of law. How serious do you think there is a failure of journalism today, generally in this country, and how does that get arrested?
Look, I think that some significant journalists, have allowed themselves to be used and manipulated by the government with information which is usually held secret. They've allowed this information to be published narrowly to benefit the agenda of the government. Michael Pezzullo, Home Affairs, when he was there, he said that he knew, I think it was a dozen journalists that he trusted. So he's got trusted journalists. Now, a trusted journalist is an unusual creature.
I mean, a lot of things.
Trusted by an executive government, not my flavour. Trusted by the public, that is my flavour. And I think that is the danger. The closeness of journalists to executive power is a problem, particularly at a time when journalism is under so much pressure because of the whole story we know about the erosion of money flowing into journalism because of the arrival of the internet, social media. So there's a problem there, and we should be on guard against this. I mean, we actually had a report in the Sydney Morning Herald 2 days ago, my recollection, which quoted an ASIO person, insider, official, in quotation, saying that ASIO had briefed Christina Keneally against meeting somebody in the Chinese community. And this was an ASIO quote. So in other words, somebody from ASIO had leaked this information. Now, I take it that ASIO was not at the door of the Sydney Morning Herald 24 hours later trying to find out who's spoken to them. What we've got here is the intelligence agencies leaking against, running a campaign against a political party. This is truly dangerous territory. And journalists need to be cautious about this. But they don't appear to be. They appear to be just embracing it and running with the stories. I mean, we have the Herald again today with Mike Burgess. I'm sure he's a wonderful person and doing a great job. But he just gets a free kick in the middle with a nice photograph talking about the, you know, the problems of dealing with extremism and explaining why we now talk about, we don't talk about right-wing extremism for some reason. We talk about various other different lone wolf extremism, which, like white supremacy and the rest of it, which appears to me to be right-wing, but that seems to be a problem for the government and a problem for the agency. To go to the central point, Kerry, I just think that for various reasons, journalists have got too close to executive power, and executives are using that, and journalists are allowing themselves to be used in bigger numbers than I've ever seen it before. And it's one of the reasons why they face against Assange, you know, because Assange stands against executive authority, against any authority at all, and that embarrasses those people who stand with executive authority.
I want to come back to the core of what we've been talking about to end the conversation today and ask you both, starting with you, Bernard, the balance that has to be struck between a government's valid need for secrecy in a democracy, genuinely in the national interest, and the public's right to know, but also the fundamental importance in protecting the rule of law. Because without the integrity and independence of our courts, what are we?
Well, you almost answered your own question, Kerry, because they are the key matters that will decide how our society goes forward into further into this century. The courts are our backstop. There has been a massive series of improper appointments to the administrative tribunals, federal administrative tribunals. Those appointments have not been properly processed and made on merit. Many, many clear politically partisan appointments both sides of politics have made, but the current government far worse. That's the beginning of the infection that could lead up the line. At this stage, our federal courts are solid, and very few appointments might be questioned by a neutral observer. That's our backstop. All else is gone. It's only the courts that are protecting us now. And there's a great deal of acceptance in the community of the form of overlordship that the executives, Labor and Liberal, and Coalition have exercised in the last 15, 20 years. The public themselves need to decide whether they want a decent and honourable and decent leadership and a decent society. It has to be brought about by instant campaigners. We've all seen the effect Grace Tame and a brave young woman from the Parliament have had on that side of the issue. I predict that leading people will emerge to campaign on the issue you signal. Leading reformists will emerge. They will rival those great reformists of the anti-slavery and all those other eras that we read about in history. There will be, in my view, the emergence of people. We see Simon Holmes at court funding and encouraging candidates for the crossbench at the next election in electorates vulnerable on base of both parties. You're going to see people emerge. Now, you see Twiggy Forrest emerge on the hydrogen issue. That's the beginning of what I think will be an emergence of very strong personalities, reformists, and the current executives of both of the major leading parties will only have themselves to blame for failing to dish up a reformist within their rank. They'll fail in that endeavour, and they'll be replaced outside the parliament by reformists who'll bring about change. At my age of 77 years, that has to be my hope, and it is indeed my prediction, Kerry.
But of course, when you've got strong voices coming outside the parliament, they can be strong voices from all kinds of perspectives, and there is unfortunately fertile ground, given the cynicism and the anxieties that operate in the public today and the sense of having been failed by democracy, that people might not just turn to those sort of quote-unquote righteous independents to find their voice, but the right-wing extremists that have become such an ugly force in the wake of Trump.
Oh, well, that's where the media must come in. It'll be the media that promote the populist voices that you speak of, Kerry, and this can't go forward without the courts, the legal profession and the media deciding that enough's enough and we need to move together. The media have a massive influence on that issue you raise.
Very brief response from you, Andrew, or comment from you on that broad issue of...
Kerry, I think that journalists need to never forget the moral calling of what they're doing. The fact is, they need to refuse to write stories that are bent. They need to argue about those issues, and they need to, if necessary, leave. They should leave organizations that run government propaganda lines, that run hate against members of the community, and who deliberately publish material designed to divide the country. They should not do that. And that argument should be had. And the union here, the MEAA, which has been very strong supporting Assange, should be center of that kind of argument. I think the issue that you raise about the courts and the legality, I think that the arguments that journalists have run for so long now after the 9/11 legislation or the various acts that were introduced, there was a lot of shimmying around the acts and saying, well, how can we protect journalists from freedom of speech here and there and everywhere else? It's an impossibility. You can't unscramble that egg. You've just got to have a law that protects journalists producing material to the benefit of Australia, for the public benefit. That general catch-all protection for journalism is what it's all about. And if you have that in place, you'll actually embolden journalists to be protected, to take a few steps further forward rather than relying upon government handouts, government leaks. And that's where the danger lies, in my opinion.
Can I thank you both for your time today and for the spirit in which you've engaged?
Thanks, Gary.
Thank you, Bernard.
Thanks very much, Gary.
I'd like to remind our audience that Bernard Collaery's book, Oil Under Troubled Waters, and Andrew Fowler's book, The Most Dangerous Man in the World, are available through the Melbourne Writers Festival partner bookshop, Readings. And thank you all for listening and supporting the festival. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.